that we did out here? No, somebody'll figure it out. Somebody like me. Not that anybody else will ever believe them. The device next to them issued a loud tone. A bright red light illuminated on the panel under the word proximity.
Nice working with you, kid, Kearns said.
He reached out a hand, and Danny Bailey took it in a firm clasp of solidarity, and just a moment later, they were gone. Chapter 44
We got you? Molly shouted. We got you? Are you really self-centered enough to believe that any of this is about you?
It's only about me because you keep putting me in the middle of it, Noah said. You people could have killed me, for God's sake, so maybe you can forgive me for taking this personally.
Hollis stayed with you every minute until they came for you. He made sure you were okay. I'm so sorry you've got a headache now, but nobody tried to kill you.
That's just great to hear. You know, you people are really incredible. My father told me this morning that something is going to happen that's going to change everything, and I'm thinking, okay, a big stock market correction, or another war going hot in South Asia, or the Middle East, or a couple of planes crashing into buildings like the last time everything changed forever. And your mother asked me to help you get away to somewhere safe. He held up the paper in his hand.
An idiot that I am! I let you lead me right to the last place on earth we should go.
I'm here to stop this thing if I can.
Well, you can't, he shouted over her. Open your eyes, for God's sake. They've got everything and you've got nothing. All you're going to do is get us both arrested or killed or put in an unmarked hole in the middle of the desert.
I have to try.
You don't have to try. I told you we can both ride this thing out. I can't believe I'm hearing myself say this, but I still want to help you, Molly. That cabin in the woods that you talked about, wherever you want to go until this blows over, I can still make that happen.
How dare you dangle that in front of me again? What do you think, that I don't want it? That I don't want you? Don't you think I'm scared and I dream some nights about getting away and never having another worry about the people like your father and what they're trying to turn this world into?
As bad as it would be to let me take care of you, it's better than dying for nothing, isn't it?
Molly's expression changed. She took a deep breath and then spoke in a much more measured tone. Before we got off the plane, you told me that you got it. You said you finally understood what I was about.
I do.
No, you don't, Noah. You have no idea. You think knowing the truth is enough? A lot of people know the truth and nothing changes. So today, after 28 years of drifting through life and taking everything from this country and never giving anything back, today you tell me you've finally seen the light and that's supposed to mean something to me?
Doesn't it?
Once you know the truth, Molly said, then you've got to live it. That's all I'm trying to do.
He saw her look up at the rearview mirror, and something froze in her.
Noah turned to look through the back window. The visibility must have stretched for miles and miles, and way back at the edge of what the eye could see, a tiny line of strobing police lights had appeared. She was driving as hard and fast as she had before, but there was something in her face, in her eyes, that he hadn't seen before. Molly was afraid, and he knew then that she wasn't afraid of the police or of going to prison. She wasn't afraid of getting killed in her cause. She wasn't even afraid of Arthur Gardner. She was afraid only that her fight was over. There'd been turning points in his life that he'd seen coming months away, but this one appeared in an instant. He was safely on one side of it a second before, just being who he'd always thought he was, and then he blinked, and he was on the other, waking up to realize who he was going to be. Up ahead, he could see that the road narrowed onto a short bridge over a shallow chasm which ran across the terrain for several hundred yards. You see the truth, and then you have to live it, she'd said. It was too late, maybe, and too little, but he knew what he needed to do.
Slow down, Noah said. I'm getting out.
What?
Don't stop. Just let me out.
He cracked the door, and the wind whipped inside, and she let her foot off the gas and braked until the car had slowed to the point where he might just survive if he stepped out onto the road whizzing by under them. There was no way to be sure if she understood what he was doing. No time to explain. Maybe he'd never know. But like she'd said, none of this was really about Noah Gardner. He took a last look at Molly. There were tears in her eyes, but she kept them firmly fixed on the way ahead. "Goodbye," Noah said. She answered, but so quietly and privately that the words clearly weren't intended to reach him. If they were never to see each other again, it seemed, this was just something that she must have wanted read into the record. Wishful thinking, maybe, but he felt he knew in his heart exactly what she had said. "I love you too." He opened the door and dropped to the pavement, rolling and bouncing and banging along for what seemed like the length of a soccer field. At last he stopped, and he watched for a few seconds as the car he'd left picked up speed again and began to recede toward the horizon. He tried to stand, but the pain prevented it, so he crawled to the center line and knelt there in the middle of the narrow bridge, hands up and out so he'd be more visible, watching the line of cars with flashing lights fast approaching. Maybe they'll stop in time, and maybe they won't, Noah thought, but either way he'd slow them down. Other than that, he knew only two things. Molly Ross was still fighting, and that despite what was bearing down on him ahead, he wasn't afraid. By the time the lead car had skidded to a stop, he could feel the heat on his face from its headlights. Some of the vehicles behind were backing up, and their drivers were trying to find a way around the bottleneck. But off the road, the sand was too soft for traction, and those who'd gone into the gully were stuck, their tires spinning uselessly. He looked up and saw five uniformed men approaching, their guns drawn. They were all shouting orders he couldn't really understand. And then they disappeared, as did the rest of the world, in a silent, split-second flash of bright white light from behind him. It was so bright that it crossed the senses. He could feel it on his back. He could hear the light and smell it. When his vision returned, Noah saw the officers standing in the road where they'd been, some covering their eyes, but most looking past him, blank-faced, their hands hanging down at their sides. He turned to look back over his shoulder, in the direction Molly had gone, and miles away he saw the rising mushroom cloud, a massive, roiling ball of fire ascending slowly into the evening sky. The expanding circle of a shockwave was tearing across the desert toward them, toward everything in all directions, and a few seconds later it arrived with a crack of thunder and the sudden gust of a hot summer wind. Chapter 45. It could have been most of the night that they worked him over. It could have been days, for all he knew. All sense of time had left him while he was still out there on the road. The questioning had started in one place, and at some point they'd satisfied themselves that the worst they could do wasn't going to be good enough. There'd been a dark ride in a car, and then a flight somewhere. At the new place, they'd started in on him again. They knew a lot already. They knew that calls had been made from Noah's apartment to a long list of accomplices of a known agitator who'd conspired to destroy an American city or two. They knew that Noah helped one of the central figures in this conspiracy gain access to classified files and information. They knew that he'd helped her evade security and fly across the country to play her part in the failed attack. They knew that two nuclear weapons had fallen into the hands of these terrorists and that one of them had detonated, but the other was still unaccounted for. This second group of interrogators was more organized and clinical in their methods and far more creative. It wasn't only pain they inflicted, but terror. The most effective torture happens in the mind. After many hours and methods, they'd eventually settled on using a reliable old standby that seemed to have the most immediate and positive effect for their purposes. Strapped flat to a cold metal table, head immobilized and inclined to be lower than the feet, a wet cloth over the face to restrict his breathing, and then just a slight dripping of water, maybe half a glass, just enough to begin to run down the nostrils and into the throat. Some primitive part of the mind simply comes unhinged when it knows it's drowning and knows it can't get away. Try to be as strong as you want. It doesn't matter. If he'd actually known anything at all that they wanted to learn, before 10 seconds had passed, he would have told them, and they would have known he was telling the truth. In the course of their work, they told him a lot of things to encourage him to break his silence. They told him that Molly's mother, under similar questioning, had revealed the entire plot, including the depth of Noah's involvement. They said that Molly herself had been apprehended, and they described in excruciating detail the particular techniques they had employed on her. She'd given him up almost immediately, they'd claimed, along with all of her co-conspirators. After all they'd put him through, Noah would have gladly believed almost anything they'd said. But even to his clouded, brutalized mind, these last two assertions didn't ring true. Those two would never betray their cause. If Molly was going down, she would go down swinging and silent. Knowing that gave Noah the first bit of hope that he'd had in a long time. It went on that way, though, again and again, as if they had nothing but time and nothing to lose by confirming over and over that he didn't know anything that could help them. They seemed to take his complete lack of useful knowledge as a sign of stubborn resistance to their questioning. And, after all, you never know when a valuable little nugget of intel might surface. And then they stopped. They spent a few minutes cleaning him up as well as they could, unstrapped one of his hands, adjusted the table to a more natural recline, and even slipped a couple of flat pillows beneath his head. They never addressed him directly, but Noah was able to gather from what they said that a special visitor was coming. Someone special enough to put a hold on the most critical interrogation since they'd captured Khalid Sheikh Mohammed 2 years after 9/11. As they prepared to leave, they put their things in order, like a team of seasoned mechanics might tend to the tools of their trade. These actions made it clear that they'd be back, if necessary, after this brief interlude, to take up their work right where they'd left it off. A number of dark plastic surveillance domes were distributed across the ceiling. The chief interrogator looked up at one of the cameras and made a gesture to those watching to indicate that the subject was now ready to receive his guest. On that cue, the tiny red lights of the surveillance cameras winked out in sequence. A few seconds later, a figure appeared in the open doorway. Chapter 46. Noah had been savaged for many hours, of course, brought to the brink mentally and physically in his interrogation. No one would blame him if he didn't immediately recognize his visitor. The man was so rarely seen outside of his natural, elegant habitat. Yet despite all of these mitigating factors, Noah knew instantly whom he was staring at, because it was his own flesh and blood, the legendary Arthur Gardner. The old man came in and walked to the middle of the room, discharged his bodyguard and the others with a slight dismissive wave, and he and Noah were left alone. His father pulled over a high stool instead of the rolling office chair that had been arranged for him. He was taking the high ground, as usual. Seated in this way, the old man towered above his son, who was still bound securely to the metal bed. For a time, they only regarded each other in silence. It might have been a bit of his father's mano-a-mano gamesmanship, often employed in business interactions. In hostile negotiations, it's often the first one to speak who loses. After a while, though, the quiet must have outlasted his patience.
"This woman you became involved with," Arthur Gardner began. "Do you have any idea what she has cost us?"
"I don't know," Noah said.
His voice was hoarse from lack of moisture and from the suffering they'd already put him through.
"Billions?"
The old man's fist came down on the edge of the table, hard enough to break a bone.
"She cost us impact!" he shouted. "It was to be a clean and spectacular event, a thing to be leveraged into a leap forward toward our new beginning. Instead, it's become a complete debacle. We were left with an almost unnoticed explosion out in the empty desert that barely rattled a teacup in the nearest town. There aren't even any pictures. We've had to resort to artists' conceptions and special effects. We'll be up all night trying to make a credible story of it all, to salvage the greatest effect we can. After all the years of preparation, it was rushed forward against my advice due to the actions of this meaningless resistance, which my son was somehow a part of.
By all appearances, his father must have been thinking that some form of apology would be appropriate at this point. Noah chose his words carefully.
I didn't set out to be, Dad.
The old man muttered something poisonous under his breath, and then seemed to make an effort to gather his dignity again. He straightened the already perfect knot of his Persian silk tie, and when he spoke again, his voice was under somewhat tighter control.
Not that it's been a total failure. Your friends lost before the fight even began. We've spent years painting them as a fringe group of dangerous heirs to the likes of Timothy McVeigh, and of course they'll be revealed as the villains behind this failed attack.
He stared off into the distance as if he were talking to no one in particular.
It's too bad that these friends of yours have been so transparent in their desire for violence. They wave signs with slogans about reloading and watering the tree of liberty with the blood of tyrants. They wear shirts that endorse the targeting of politicians. And, Noah, let's not forget about that unfortunate incident you got yourself caught up in at that downtown bar. These people never wanted to give peace a chance, and now they've shown just how far they are willing to go to send their message.
He was actually smiling, clearly enjoying a sadistic satisfaction with it all.
Thankfully, there's already talk of suspending the presidential election. Though either candidate would have been equally useful in the aftermath, it will be a powerful bit of symbolism nevertheless. Many sweeping pieces of helpful legislation will be rushed through in the coming days with little or no debate, and those will be used to clamp down further on what remains of this Ross woman's pitiful movement. And, naturally, a wholesale roundup is underway to ferret out all those connected with these backward revolutionaries, with full support of the media and the cowering public. Saul Alinsky was right, Noah. The ends do justify the means. I can't imagine how any thinking person could believe otherwise. Which do you really think the huddled masses would prefer if they knew what I know? That they have only two choices? A quick, if somewhat painful, transformation, or yet another century of slow progress and suffering toward the same inevitable end, only this time with all of the country's wealth and potential stolen away from them before the decay even begins. And yet, these selfish and ignorant meddlers, patriots they have the gall to call themselves, they would stand in the path of destiny. What do they think they've accomplished? The lives of how many were saved tonight? 30,000? 5 times that many die around the globe every day. They die in obscurity at the end of an aimless existence, and they disappear to dust as though they'd never been. But those 30,000, they would have died for a cause greater than any other. Their names would have been etched in monuments in the New World, on the granite markers heralding mankind's new beginning. One world, ruled by the wise and the fittest and the strong, with no naive illusions of equality or the squandered promises of freedom for all. How many times must we learn the same lessons? Leave the useless eaters to their pursuit of happiness, and the result is always slaughter and chaos and poverty and despair. What your new friends fail to see is that this country was nothing more than a brief anomaly, a mere passing second in the march of time. People often ask how slavery could have happened, but that just shows their ignorance. Slavery and tyranny have been the rule for thousands of years. Freedom is the short-lived exception. The United States should never have survived as long as it has. But all good things must come to an end. The system is broken beyond repair.
It costs $1 billion to run for president these days. Abraham Lincoln would never have lasted past the Iowa caucuses. And if the occasional visionaries actually make it into office, their corruption begins immediately. They're overcome by the problems they inherit. But the majority of politicians are only prostitutes and puppets, and they always will be. Their simple-minded lusts for money and sex and power make them controllable. But they disgust me. When they've served their purpose, they'll learn what real power is, along with everyone else. Whatever chance we have to take control of this world is in controlling who pulls the strings. Presidents, senators, governors, all of these come and go. But I and my peers have been here all along, raising them up and tearing them down. The real enduring powers in this world are older than any modern government, and it's past time that we put an end to these empty dreams of liberty. Now we openly take the reins. Now we'll give the people the government they've shown themselves to deserve. No one knows the people better than I do, and I know what they need. We'll give them a purpose, a simple, regimented, peaceful life with all the reasonable comforts in service of something greater than any single selfish nation. The old man stood, walked to the door, rapped on the frame 3 times, and then came back and took his seat again. After a moment, others entered the room, a different group of professionals than Noah had seen before. "Your mother," Noah's father began, "meant a great deal to me. I saw in her my last hopes for humanity. She had her weaknesses, but in thinking back on it now, those weaknesses may have been what drew me to her. She believed in people, for one, that the good in them could outweigh the bad. For the brief time I was with her, a touch of those weaknesses even spread to me. We had a child together, though I'd sworn I'd never bring another human being into this world, but she poured all of her innocent dreams into her son. And as she lay dying, your mother told me that I should expect to see wonderful things from you, Noah. I've held on to that hope. But as I stood out there just now, watching outside this room for the preceding hour, I had to wonder if this was to be the end of my ambitions for you."
"Your ambitions for me?"
"Believe it or not, my boy, I won't live forever. There's much to do before I die. The outcome of my life's work is still very much in doubt, and I need help to see it through. I need your help. My wish has been that you would someday stand beside me as we bring forth this new world together. You have great gifts, Noah, but those gifts have been kept dormant by a trick of heredity. I know you've felt this conflict, and it must have been quite painful at times. You have your father's mind, but your mother's heart. Neither will permit the other to come to the fore. But it seems you may have been exposed to a disease in your thinking over the last few days. I am familiar with this infection, and once it takes hold in a person, I'm afraid it's shown itself to be quite incurable. It will be with you until you die, in other words. And so, before you can help me, Noah, before I can trust you to do so, we must be certain that this woman and her friends haven't passed you a sickness that cannot be permitted to spread." The technicians had already begun their preparations. Now some brought heavy copper cables and electrodes and fastened these to various points on Noah's body with wraps of white tape. A cold dab of conductive gel was applied to his temple on one side, and then on the other. "I'm here to save you, Noah," his father said, "one way or the other, and to preserve my legacy. One of 2 young men will leave this room with me. The first was taken hostage by this Ross woman and her terrorist militia, but he managed to escape
and then bravely risked his life by standing in the road to prevent a group of policemen and federal agents from being killed in that terrible explosion in the desert. This man is a hero, and will carry on my work and be my eyes and ears in the field as our plans proceed. The other man played a part in a similar story, with one sad exception. This other man is dead. Arthur Gardner nodded to one of the seated technicians. "And now," he said, "let's find out together, once and for all, if Noah Gardner is really his father's son." Chapter 47. They'd refashioned his bonds in a manner that would still restrain him, but with less likelihood of causing him to injure himself in the course of the coming ordeal. He was instructed to bite down on a length of hard rubber hose they'd placed between his teeth. What they did, they'd learned from decades of trial and error and thousands of prisoners who'd been down this last road before him. Even in a clinical setting, electroconvulsive therapy was far more an art than a science. The results were never fully known until the procedure was finished. The goals were different here, but their main purpose was plain: to destroy any remaining will to resist or evade, so the truth would be the only thing he'd be left capable of speaking. For a long while, his father sat silently next to the metal table as the technicians administered the voltage with a jeweler's precision. Noah could hear the screams, and he knew they were his, but a small part of him was detached enough to simply observe the suffering. His mind, once his greatest, if least used, asset, was no longer under his control. He couldn't focus on the technicians or the pain, and he'd long ago stopped wondering how much longer it would go on. All that was left were random snapshots of the past that flashed uninvited into his head. All his defenses had left him hours before. In this state, if he'd had any information to reveal, he would have gladly offered it. But they were now probing for something much deeper than mere intelligence. Each time he thought there was nothing left, they found another fragile layer of his soul to peel away. In the end, when all he could see was darkness, whatever was left of him finally gave in and tried its best to surrender. As if sensing it was finished, the old man stood from the rickety wooden stool and stood over his son.
"Come now, Noah, I think we are both finding out what kind of man you are, and I have to tell you, it's quite disappointing." He referred briefly to a sheet of notes he'd been handed. "Inconclusive. I'm sure you know that's a word I hate more than any other. And doesn't it place a sad little period at the end of the story of a rather aimless and forgettable young life? While you've given us nothing that implicates you in the treachery of the preceding days, you've also said nothing to exonerate yourself to my side of the conflict. A true believer or a traitor to the cause, either one of those I could at least respect. But you're weak, aren't you? And fatally so." Neither of Noah's eyes would fully open, and what vision he had was dim and watery. His father looked like a giant silhouette, a featureless shadow. Fragments of memories intruded, a flash from the office break room when he'd first seen Molly. But her image was replaced in his mind with the outline of seven light strokes from a felt-tip pen. "Continue," his father said to the technicians. The lines that had once represented Molly's exquisite form dissolved into a pool of blackness and pain.
"Noah, I told you this when you were only a boy, so I doubt you'll remember." His father had retaken his position at the side of the table. "It's a rhyme I made up for you, in answer to some childish question you'd posed. I think it fitting in our present situation." When he spoke again, the old man's voice had taken on a softer, more fatherly tone. "There are men who are weak, and a few who are strong. There are men who are right, and more who are wrong. But of all the men huddled
in all the world's hives, there's but one thing that's true. It's the fit who'll survive. Noah, the meek will not inherit the earth. A faint heart is as great a weakness as a feeble mind. It pains me to say it, but I'm afraid we've reached a parting of the ways. It was then that Noah felt something beneath him and behind him, all around him, something outside himself that he couldn't quite identify. His father's mind, his mother's heart. What the old man had given him was all that these men could tear away, but it was her heart that they couldn't quite reach. His mother had passed it on to him, and even after her strength had lain unused and scarcely remembered for all these wasted years, it seemed that Molly Ross had somehow awakened it again. The idea of dying wasn't nearly as frightening as he would have thought it would be. But somewhere he also knew that this wasn't how it was supposed to end. Molly had taught him the importance of living to fight another day. She hadn't been captured. She hadn't been killed. A spirit like that doesn't die so easily. He had no facts whatsoever to assure him of this, but he knew it. Maybe it was a bit of that faith that she'd spoken of. The old man pulled away with a stoic finality and picked up his suit jacket, which had been folded neatly over the back of the office chair. As he put it on, he turned to the man who was clearly in charge of things. "Finish the job and then craft a story to ensure my son is remembered in a way that will bring dignity and honor to our family." There was a way out of this, but Noah didn't know what it was until he heard the answer whispered at his ear, as though Molly were there right beside him. The fight would go on, she'd said, with her on the outside and him on the inside, where she'd already shown him that the deepest kind of damage could be done. And then she added one thing more. "Don't be afraid." As the old man turned away, Noah tried to speak the words she'd given him, but his mouth and lips were so dry that the words were barely audible.
"As it will be in the future," he whispered. "It was at the birth of man."
He didn't even know if he was saying the words aloud or reciting them only in his mind.
"There are only four things certain since social progress began."
His father's hand was on the doorknob when he suddenly froze and looked back.
"What did you say?"
the old man asked. Noah continued, his voice becoming stronger.
"That the dog returns to his vomit, and the sow returns to her mire."
His father had taken a few steps closer to him now.
"And the burnt fool's bandaged finger goes wobbling back to the fire."
Arthur Gardner's usually dispassionate face, so long accustomed to the denial of emotion, could not contain his surprise. He resumed his seat next to the man and motioned the others from the room. The old man leaned close and squeezed his son's hand. Noah smiled as best he could and let his father believe what he surely thought he was seeing.
"I knew it was in there somewhere," Arthur Gardner said. "We had to strip all of the other nonsense away, but there it is, from the root of your being, the essence of what I've taught you. I knew you couldn't forget, though I must admit that you had me concerned."
Noah looked directly into his father's keen, discerning eyes and nodded.
"Those people you were with," the old man continued, "they somehow believe that we can have a brighter future by resurrecting the failed ideas of the past. They're wrong, and their ideas would lead to untold misery for millions. The answer is a new vision, my vision, and together we can make it a reality."
Noah realized something else then, another thing that Molly had taught him. When you lie for a living, you sometimes can't see the truth even when it's staring you right in the face. That's a weakness that could clearly be exploited. It was a matter of pride with Arthur Gardner that his heir should be involved in the transformation that was coming. His son, then, would do his best to prove the adage that pride comes before the fall. The old man smiled. The ordeal was finished, and though he clearly felt he'd won the day, what Arthur Gardner couldn't know was that the battle lines had only just been drawn. Noah felt himself fading, and he spoke again, but scarcely at a whisper. These words were meant for different ears, and wherever Molly was, he knew for certain she would hear them.
"We have it in our power," Noah said, "to begin the world over again."
Epilogue. A month to the day had passed since Noah had arrived in his new quarters. The days in this place had started to meld into one another, so he'd resorted to noting each sunrise with a mark on one of the painted bricks in the wall near his bed. While actual calendars were available for residents of his moderate status, these private etchings seemed to be a more fitting method to keep a tally of his time inside. With the stub of a pencil from the nightstand, he inscribed another X at the end of the last line, and then he began another empty grid beside the first, in anticipation of the new month to come. Noah was familiar with the atmosphere of a dormitory, though he'd never actually had to live in one while in college. That was the style of accommodations this place most resembled. Just a simple bedroom with a pressed wood desk and a shared bath, more than a cell, but considerably less than a real apartment. Some no-nonsense designer had tacked on a veneer of generic warmth just sufficient to allow the space to be thought of as a modest home by its resident, rather than as a place of confinement. Two floors down, it was more like a barracks, and the levels below those floors weren't on the tour. A man walked by out in the hall, glancing briefly through the window and the door as he passed. Not a guard, Noah had been reminded at his orientation, but more of a floor monitor, just a benign, overseeing administrator, there for security and safety. And this wasn't a prison, not at all, the welcoming committee had gone on to emphasize. This complex and its surrounding buildings might have been originally constructed as a prison, but funding cuts and changes in policy had orphaned the place in recent years. Local officials in the small Montana town nearby had been delighted to learn that their costly investment might finally be put to profitable use, providing local employment and helping the country deal with its recent declared emergency. The old man had arranged his son's reservation here, and his job. As soon as he'd healed, Noah was to become a key asset in the all-important public relations push behind the nation's unfolding brave new direction. He wouldn't return to New York right away. He'd be a sort of field correspondent, helping to manage the flow of information from the ongoing fight against the dangerous homegrown forces who'd recently declared open war on American progress. Noah's original accommodations had actually been much nicer, a private suite on one of the upper floors. But his unsatisfactory performance in his first real work assignment had resulted in his lodgings being downgraded a notch. This failed assignment had been pretty straightforward. He was to write up an in-depth piece for the news, outlining the inner workings of the recent homegrown conspiracy that had nearly led to the destruction of Las Vegas and San Francisco. The story was to be told from his own point of view as a courageous hostage and unwilling insider. His first draft was rejected immediately. There'd been a consistent undertone in the text that seemed to paint the ringleaders, the founders' keepers, in a subtly but unacceptably positive light. His second try wasn't an improvement. It was even worse. The strange thing was, if only out of self-preservation, Noah had been trying hard to write what they wanted, but the stubborn truths just kept elbowing their way in. After an informal inquiry, this first glitch was chalked up to the lingering effects of the Stockholm Syndrome, that passing mental condition through which hostages sometimes develop an odd sympathy for the cause of their captors. For the time being, it was determined that, until he was better, Noah would be given less demanding duties and an additional editor to watch over his work. There was no shortage of things to do, large and small. A lot of PR spin needed to be applied to the changes that were already well underway across the country. Noah was given a stack of small writing tasks, mostly one-liners and fillers that required far less of a commitment to the web of new truths being woven for consumption by the press and the public. For one of these jobs, he was to simply come up with a suitably harmless-sounding name for a new Treasury Bureau that would be put in charge of the next wave of government bailouts for various failing corporations and industries. This was the work of only a few seconds. Noah called it the Federal Resource Allocation and Underwriting Division. Nearly a truckload of boxes of letterhead and business cards had been printed before someone in production noticed the problem. The five-letter acronym for this new government bureau would be FRAUD. They said they believed him when he told them it was an accident, but they'd also moved Noah to this more secure probationary floor of the residence building just as a temporary precaution. "Once you know the truth," Molly had said, "then you've got to live it." What she'd apparently neglected to add was that you'll also tend to randomly tell it, whether it gets you into trouble or not. Noah rearranged his pillows and lay down on his cot, not with an intention to sleep, but just to rest his eyes for a while and try to clear his head. A thousand things were flying through his mind. It was a condition that his father referred to as a topical storm, a state in which so many conflicting thoughts are doing battle in your brain that you lose your ability to discern and to act on any of them. This state was regularly induced by PR experts to cloud and control issues in the public discourse, to keep thinking people depressed and apathetic on election days, and to discourage those who might be tempted to actually take a stand on a complex issue. They'd given Noah a radio and a small TV, but he knew those wouldn't help to clarify anything for him. On the contrary, the emergency alert system had kicked in shortly after the thwarted attack, and though some individual stations and networks were active again, the news still had the distinctive sameness of single-source coverage. While no real disaster had actually happened, the selected news people were breathlessly working 24/7 to puff up the disasters that might have happened and what might still be looming ahead tomorrow. Fear, uncertainty, and doubt, the three most effective weapons in the arsenal of Arthur Gardner, were keeping the country in an uneasy state of tension and helplessness, much like his own. What can one person do? That was the passive rhetorical question that kept people silent and powerless in the face of things that seemed too large and frightening to overcome. It was the question in Noah's mind as well. Now I see the truth, and yes, I want to live it, but what can I do? He decided to sleep on that, because so far he'd been unable to come up with a good answer. Noah brushed his teeth and washed as soon as the bathroom was free, left the sink and the shower and the commode a lot cleaner than he'd found them, dressed for bed, and turned in. He rolled over onto his side and saw his first filled calendar grid, with the second empty one beside it on the wall. Where would he be a month from now? That answer seemed depressingly certain. But then, where might Molly be? Asking that question had become a nightly ritual at the end of these dreary days, and it was still on his mind as he fell asleep a while later on. There was no hard transition between consciousness and the beginning of his now familiar dream. Noah opened his eyes and looked around. He was in the small, warm family room of a rustic little cabin. Surrounding him were simple furnishings, handmade quilts, and corner shelves of keepsakes and photographs. Unlike the mass-produced, impersonal flash of the world he'd left behind, the things here had been built and woven and carved and finished by skilled, loving hands, things made or given by friends and family, made to mean something, to be passed on, and to last through generations. Snow fluttered down outside the wide windows, big flakes sticking and blowing past the frosted panes, an idyllic woodland scene framed in pleated curtains and knotty pine. He was sitting in front of a stone hearth. A pair of boots were drying there, with space for another, smaller pair beside. A fire was burning low, a black Dutch oven suspended above the coals, the smell of some wonderful meal cooking inside. Two plates and silver settings were arranged on a nearby dining table. A simple evening lay ahead. though it might seem nearly identical to 100 other nights he'd spent with her, he also knew it would be unlike any other, before or after. It always was. Being with Molly, talking with her, listening to her, enjoying the quiet with her, feeling her close to him, thinking of the future with her. Every night was like a perfect first date, and every morning like the first exciting day of a whole new life together. Like Molly had said, such a simple existence certainly wasn't for everyone, but the freedom to choose one's own pursuit of happiness, that's what her country was founded on, and that's what she was fighting for. Noah heard a sound at the entrance, and he turned to welcome her home again. But when he looked, it was a different room he saw around him. He blinked repeatedly, but the reality he'd woken up to wouldn't disappear so easily. The man from the hall was looking through the window in the frame, beckoning Noah to the door. He sighed, got up, walked over, and turned the lock. It was only a formality, of course. It wasn't as though the guy outside didn't have a key of his own. After the usual pleasantries, the man in the hall offered Noah a tray from the rolling cart beside him.
"Looks like I woke you up. Sorry about that."
"That's okay," Noah said. "What's for dinner?" The man lifted the round stainless steel cover from the plate on the tray.
"Sure looks like Thursday to me," he replied.
"Ah, my favorite." The man had nearly returned to his cart, but he stopped and came nearer again.
"Say, I see you here every day, and it occurred to me tonight we've never been properly introduced."
Noah put down his tray on the side table inside his door. "I'm Noah Gardner." The man nodded and casually glanced left and then right down the hallway before he answered quietly, "My friends call me Nathan.
I've got a message for you.
Would you mind if I came in for just a moment?"
"Of course. Come on in." He stepped aside and closed the door as the other man walked past him into the room. Noah watched as he unplugged the TV, ran his fingers along the edges of the desk as though feeling for something hidden, and then clicked on the radio and turned it up loud enough to establish some covering background noise.
"What is this?" Noah began, and before he could finish that question, he found himself pushed hard against the wall with a forearm pressed against his neck and the other man's face close to his.
"You want to know what this is?" Nathan hissed. "It's a wake-up call. You're in a valuable position, my friend, and we need for you to snap out of it and start doing the work we need done."
He adjusted his grip on Noah's collar and continued,
"Now listen closely. Tomorrow, at your job, you sign into your computer right before you leave for the day, but you don't sign out. Here's a key."
Noah felt something shoved roughly into his pocket.
"And you're going to leave that key under the mouse pad on the desk, two places down from yours, to your left. Got all that?"
Noah nodded as best he could.
"I hope you do," Nathan said.
He took a step back, smiled, and straightened his clothing as if the two of them had just been engaging in some mutual, spirited roughhousing.
"To quote a good friend of mine," he added on his way to the door, "if they're going to call this treason anyway, we might as well make the most of it."
"Wait," Noah said.
"Enjoy your dinner," Nathan said, and with that he left the room and resumed his walk down the hall, pushing his meal cart. "The meatloaf ain't much, but I think you'll like the dessert."
Noah closed the door and stared at the tray of covered plates on the table in front of him. He went right to the smallest of them, lifted the lid, and found exactly what he was looking for inside, a lukewarm square of runny peach cobbler. He took the knife, cut down the center, and just as he'd hoped, felt it hit something solid. He extracted the object from the gooey syrup, took it to the sink in the bathroom, locked the door to the adjoining room, and held it under the cold running water until it was washed clean. It was Molly's silver bracelet. He held it close to his eyes. Maybe the words engraved there were a little more worn than they'd been before, but he would have remembered them even if they'd been gone completely. She was alive. Whatever other message he'd been hoping for, whatever guidance he'd been seeking, this was better. Not just a plan, because a plan can be defeated. This was a foundation. As he returned to the bedroom, he remembered the key he'd been given, and he pulled it from his pocket. It was wrapped in paper, and as he unfolded it, Noah saw the simple words written there in Molly's familiar handwriting.
"We're everywhere. Stay with us. I'll see you soon. The fight starts tomorrow."
Afterword. Believe those who are seeking the truth. Doubt those who find it. Andre Gide. There's a very good reason we call this book The Overton Window, and it's not just because it's one of the techniques that Arthur Gardner uses to push his objectives. We chose this title because it's also a technique that, to one extent or another, we just used on you. The key difference is, I'm openly telling you that's what I'm doing. I don't have a hidden agenda here. In the course of listening to and thinking about this story, it's simply my hope that you've spent a bit of time entertaining ideas that you might not have considered before. Remember, the Overton Window concept is that only a few scenarios that currently sit inside an established window of acceptable debate will be taken seriously by the public. To move the window toward their ultimate goal, those pushing an agenda have to introduce radical ideas that fall outside of the current comfort zone. While those fringe ideas will normally be dismissed, the window will also be subtly nudged in their direction. This allows ideas that would have previously seemed unthinkable to be introduced and, eventually, even seriously proposed as solutions. Applying this concept to our story, it should be obvious that we set out to create a plot based in reality, and then we pushed it to an absolute extreme. It's one of the intriguing potentials of this sort of fiction. When your mind suspends disbelief, it may also become more willing to consider a broader spectrum of possible outcomes to the events and the agendas that are playing out around us every single day. For example, fighter pilots often use flight simulators to train for real combat. In a safe environment, these simulators force pilots to consider a confluence of events that would otherwise seem ridiculous, like dual engine failure while being shot at and simultaneously having to land on an aircraft carrier in 30-foot seas. It's extreme, but it works. Many pilots who have been through hair-raising missions in a live war zone come out saying that it wasn't nearly as bad as what they had faced in the simulator. This audiobook is your simulator. It's unlikely that we'll face anything close to the challenges that Noah and Molly are up against, but after experiencing their scenario in its fictional setting, maybe it can become a little easier to have a deeper conversation about the important forces that are actually at work in the real world. As I told you at the outset, while I certainly used a lot of dramatic license, this story is loaded with truth. But the facts can easily be manipulated. So I'm asking you to decide for yourself exactly what is fact and what is based on fact. What is a common belief possibly based on a distorted fact? And what is complete fiction? Every day on my radio and television shows, we make distinctions between fact and fiction, and we present you with the truth about what's going on in our world today. But please, don't rely on me or us alone. Find the truth on your own. Let me help you get started. In the prologue, Eli Churchill mentions to Molly's mother, Beverly. Did you pick up that he was speaking to her on the payphone? That in late summer of 2001, Donald Rumsfeld announced that the U.S. government could not account for $2.3 trillion. That actually happened. The date? September 10th, 2001. A day later, some missing money, even though it was trillions, didn't seem quite so important anymore. And here's the source. Rumsfeld announces $2.3 trillion unaccounted for on September 10th, 2001. Defense Department cannot account for 25% of funds, $2.3 trillion. CBS News, January 29th, 2002. On a small side note, if you were wondering what a phone booth was doing out in the desert in the middle of nowhere, this is an interesting location that actually existed until fairly recently. Google Mojave Phone Booth to learn more. This is only a starting point. If a passage or a statement in the book intrigued you, take a minute and type some keywords into your favorite search engine. Try KFC, UN Security, from Chapter 17, for example. You might be surprised at where your search will lead you. By taking steps like this, by getting to the bottom of issues that affect and shape your life, you can determine where your own Overton window should be located as we continue to debate what kind of America we all want to live in.
The Overton Window was written by Glenn Beck, with contributions from Kevin Balfe, Emily Bessler, and Jack Henderson. It was read by James Daniels, with an author note and afterword read by the author. The Overton Window was directed and recorded by Andrew Twiss at Twiss Audio in Chicago. Editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, technical director. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. It was produced by Karen DiMattia. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Overton Window is available in hardcover from Threshold. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Idiots Unplugged by Glenn Beck, based on the Glenn Beck radio program. And Arguing with Idiots by Glenn Beck, read by Glenn Beck, Stuber Gear, and Pat Gray.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.